going to yield to the city manager for the 2012 Social Service Funding Report.
Very good. Just one agenda item. We will try to squeeze in one five-minute discussion at the end under other matters from Larry Grossman regarding the number of wards in the city, as per a request from Councilmember Kespel. So the first item is from the Boone County Community Services Advisory Commission, and Stephanie Browning will take us through.
Okay. Real quick, let me introduce Steve Hollis, our Human Services Manager, and Kathy Thorpe, who's the chair of our commission this year. And there are a number of our commissioners out here in the audience. Just raise your hands real quick. I came here to listen to this as well. The contracts that you have before you tonight on the agenda, on the consent agenda, are for the next year. Some will be up to three-year contracts. And what we wanted to do tonight was have an opportunity to prepare or present some of the findings in advance of your meeting so you can see some of the work that they've been doing. So they're going to give you about 10 minutes worth. So turn it over. Go ahead, Kathy.
All right. Good evening. My name is Kathy Thorpe, and I am the chair of the Boone County Community Services Advisory Commission. Our commission is charged with making annual funding recommendations to the Columbia City Council and Boone County Commission regarding the purchase of social services in our community. The commission's recommendations for fiscal year 2012, along with information regarding the process utilized by the commission in formulating them, are presented to the City Council and County Commission in the form of an annual report. I believe this year's report was sent to Council in advance of this meeting. Tonight, I would like to provide a brief overview of our funding process and this year's recommendations. I would also like to spend some of our time outlining the issue which is being addressed in the current funding cycle, which is children, youth, and families. Our report provides an overview of the social service funding allocation process, as well as a link to the city, county social services funding policy. It is important to note that this is a purchase of service model. It is not a grant process, and the funding is not intended to support agencies. Rather, the goal is to purchase high quality services which address priority social issues and affect positive outcomes at the individual and community levels. In order to solicit these services, staff and the commission issue targeted requests for proposals and staggered three-year cycles by service area. The targeted RFPs and contract recommendations are informed by both an independent analysis of the priority issues, as well as an independent evaluation of the program services being purchased in each issue area. Both the analysis and evaluation are conducted in the third year of the contract cycle. This allows the commission and staff to assess the performance and quality of currently contracted services, as well as the impact these services have had on the issue being addressed. This information is then used to develop progressively more informed, targeted RFPs and funding recommendations. Links to the current analysis and evaluation reports were included in this year's funding report. In its review of proposals and development of recommendations for the purchase of services to address the issues of low-income children, youth, and families, the Commission utilized the objective information from the issues analysis. The Commission considered the following sub-issues as outlined in the analysis report: teen pregnancy, academic achievement, mental health, child welfare and safety, child and youth homelessness, positive youth development, positive family development, and school readiness. Data indicators are included for each sub-issue and are utilized to prioritize limited funding and assess the impact of services purchased. Examples of these data measures include the rates of teen pregnancy, school dropouts, substance use, child abuse and neglect, child and youth homelessness, families in poverty, and juvenile arrests. Where possible, data for Columbia and Boone County are compared to state and national rates. Also, indicators are compared by race wherever possible because, unfortunately, persons of color tend to be disproportionately affected by the issues we are addressing. The analysis also includes an assessment of the current demographic, social, and economic conditions in the community, an inventory of resources, and a compilation of evidence-based programs and settings. Using the components of the analysis, prioritization matrices were developed in order to guide the funding recommendations which are outlined in our report. Based on the evaluation an analysis and its review and rating of the proposals to provide children, youth, and family services, the Commission has recommended the city contract for 17 program services provided by 10 organizations totaling $266,000 in city funding. Excuse me. One agency, Fund City, appealed the Commission's preliminary funding recommendations. However, due to previous contractual non-performance issues, the submission of an unresponsive proposal, and failure to submit a current financial engagement statement, this Commission could not recommend the city contract with the agency at this time. Due to city funds being withheld from agencies for contract noncompliance in 2010, a special RFP was also issued for additional economic opportunity services to be provided in 2012. Based on the four proposals, the Commission has recommended the city contract for three program services provided by three organizations totaling $122,700 in city funding. Under the other four service categories, the Commission has recommended the city renew service agreements for 24 program services, as well as the allocation of funding for in-home service contracts administered on behalf of the city by the Division of Human Services. Clearly, the amount of funding is not enough to fully address the needs of children, youth, and families in our community. However, the Commission feels that these funding recommendations propose the best utilization of limited funds in addressing the most critical issues. On behalf of the Commission, I would like to thank the City Council for its long-standing support of social services in our community. Anybody have any questions?
Questions from Council? Comments from staff?
You said Fund City was the only one not funded this year.
The only one not recommended.
For funding.
Funding, yes.
I also saw a zero on Phoenix programs. That
may not be. Oh, the only one that had appealed the decision. Yes, there are Phoenix programs.
Okay.
One of their programs was given some funding or recommended for funding, and one of their programs was not.
And Phoenix is currently contracted for another program as well. It was just one new program they proposed that they didn't recommend funding for.
I can just say that I appreciate the diligence that the Commission puts into evaluating these service organizations, and I appreciate the oversight. It's extremely helpful for us to know that your commitment is really helping us focus on our priorities. So thank you very much.
If I could add, I would also like to thank you for your hard work and your diligence and for establishing focused criteria and working on programs. And I know there's a great need out there, and we need to find more money down the line to go to these areas. So thank you for your work, and it's a difficult time.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next item as we transition is utility assistance programs.
That would be us.
Short transition.
Easy, easy. You looked out there thinking it was Tad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have a project tracker that's open right now that basically council was asking us to take a look at how we could improve our utility assistance services. And so we've been having, it's something we've had a lot of discussion on, and I thought that we would come back and maybe talk to you a little bit about sort of short-term strategy and then a bit of a longer-term strategy, because I don't want you to think if we're not replying to the project tracker that we're being slow to act. So I just want to give you a little update. So I think you all know that utility assistance resources have definitely declined while the rates of utilities and the number of people needing assistance have gone up. We have our program, Cash and Help, which has been in place since 1982. And basically, you know, we help low-income households with children, individuals over the age of 60, and adults with disabilities through those programs. And those are donated dollars, for the most part, from residents in our community. And we've seen over the last 10 years where donations have decreased by about 30%. And in a nutshell, we had about a little over 300 requests per month on average for utility assistance, and we're able to help about 38 households, which is about 12% of the requests that come in. Now, we've been keeping track as we do our eligibility assistance interviews, and what we're finding is that the utility bills, the utility costs, are averaging between 24% and 35% of the household income for many of the people that we're serving. So it's a big chunk of their overall income.
Did you say
24 to 35% is on the average. And, of course, that makes sense because if you think about people that may be living on Social Security or, you know, a disability check of some sort, and the amount of that payment, a utility bill could easily be a third of that if it's a fixed income. So we see that there's sort of two issues. There's the what we call a process issue, and then there's a resource issue. And the process issue in our discussions, we think we can start to address fairly quick. In fact, we'd like to move forward with this in January if it seems like a workable plan to you. Our current system, it's very difficult for a person. There's some limitations. Let's put it this way. If you call you call our office, we have a hotline, and we take the numbers in the order that they call. We have somebody who takes all the numbers off, and we call back each number in the order they come. So we try to keep it as fair as possible. We have a social worker that works about 20 hours a week, and the bulk of her time, the first day of the month, our money is gone within hours. So then the rest of the month is spent calling back people, telling them, no, I'm sorry, we're out of funds. Here's how it works for the next year or the next month. The bad part is if you're number two on the list, you made it second in on this answering machine, and you're not at your phone when we return that call, we have to go on to the next person because the requests are so many. So it kind of penalizes somebody who doesn't have access, ready access to a phone. It penalizes people that may be at work that cannot take a call when that call comes back. And so we've had this issue also with our dental program. So what we're proposing is to change that and open up our hours much more, allow people to submit their applications in, you know, by mail, fax, electronically, drop them off at the phone, at the office, and put their documentation with it, and then we'll review them. We'll make a list of, you know, people that are eligible. And basically every month, when the money is available, we will go in and do like a web-based random number-generated process so that, you know, if there's 15 applications and your name comes up in that 15, we call you and we notify you that you're available, that you can get assistance. We've been doing that for our dental program for the last year.
Yeah.
And it's worked really well. The feedback from the people that we're serving is much improved. The complaints are less. You know, I mean, we get people that get, when you're in challenging economic times and you're feeling those financial stresses, people can naturally get a little bit stressed out. And sometimes it manifests itself in the office with our staff. So I think from a security perspective, it's a better bet as well. By opening up the way that people can apply, we don't make transportation issues as apparent as they are now. Now you have to come in and actually bring your documentation in. If we make it electronic mail, you know, for people with mobility issues, that'll be improved. So I think it's going to be a much better system, and we can go with this in January. We're prepared to move forward. We will still continue to screen every application to see if people are eligible for other services or if we can direct them in other places in the community to help out. So the long-term issue is the biggest one. It's like, how do we generate additional resources so that we can help more than 12% of the people that are needing assistance? And Steve and I have been starting to do a little bit of research on how other communities are handling things. And there's a lot of different models out there. And so we'd like to have a little bit of time to explore that. We have some partners we work with in the community. We work with Water and Light quite closely, of course. Central Missouri Community Action Agency receives a significant amount of funding that comes in, and we coordinate our referring back and forth with each other. We've been working with several folks from the city that are working on the whole Barbara Buffalo and some of the Water and Light folks and the people, Lee's folks over in, you know, community services, neighborhood services, to figure out how we can improve weatherization. So we would like to try to tie that to our model program if we can. But I think there's some good things we can do, but they're not quite as fast as being able to turn around the process issues. So that's kind of where we want to move forward with the budget, have something that we bring forward to you that is a model program for Columbia. So any questions?
Two.
Yes.
One on the short term, mm-hmm. do they have to reapply every month then, or they
no,
can have a
they
continuing?
Would be eligible for a year.
Okay, great.
And then what the social services worker would do is the name comes up and they would call, you know, check with the utility to make sure they're still a current eligible customer, and all those would be met, and then we just move forward from there. So the nice part is we will spend more time being able to do true social services work, and less time just returning calls off of an answering machine.
Better use.
It's a much better use, more efficient, yes.
And then on the long term, mm-hmm. When do you expect to have some recommendations?
Well, we'd like to bring it forward in just our conversations with the city manager and the finance director, and, you know, we'd like to bring something forward with the budget, have something that's ready to go. So it'll be a couple months. With our budget request, we just start working on budget in spring. So,
I know the city has done a little bit of more advertising on the web with the Cash and Help program. How has that? Is that boosting the donations or?
I checked that. We checked today, yeah. And we pretty much. I think it started in October. I started to hear more of them on the radio, and we are not 100% certain, but we think our November amount compared to last year in November was slightly down. So we think December is going to be the better month to tell, because, like, I know I just had my electric bill come, and that was in it. So it might not have taken place in November. So we can let you know in December.
I need to beef up the advertisement on that. We'll see. Yeah, we'll see. And the long and the short of it is we need more money now.
Right, right. And the other thing, you know, the funding for utility assistance, we have not only the Cash and Help program, but Steve wanted me to mention that we also do the utility assistance for Boone Electric. So we would certainly be hoping, as we're working through our future plan, that they come along with us on that too.
They say Cash and Help are down 35% over the last 10 years.
30% over 10 years, yeah.
And what percent of the needs do you think we're meeting?
Well,
12%.
I think that's hard. I would have to guess with City Cash and Help, I would say we probably, and this is just the people who we call and reach, but I would estimate around 10% of the people who actually get through and talk to us about asking for help. You know, if you look at the percentage of people we help as compared to the population that's eligible income-wise, it's a very small fraction.
Any indication of why you think, other than economic,
right.
Any indication of why the donations are down? We have more citizens. You know, we've got 28% more people than we did 10 years ago, and yet so 35% decline per capita is probably close to 40 or 50% per capita decline.
Yeah, I couldn't say with certainty why it's down. You know, I think that there's usually a big push once a year with your utility bill. There's an insert with your electric bill that if you missed it, you know, I think we need to be more purposeful in how that's being marketed, and we've been working with Connie Kaplowitz on that. You know, that maybe enough people just don't know. The other thing we've talked about is that, you know, we should be thinking with this new program, not just calling it Cash and Help. It should have a better name. It should have, maybe we need to, right now the current program is for families with low-income kids. It's for, you know, the elderly and people with disabilities. But, you know, Stephen, I've had sort of this fundamental discussion about is it, okay, those are important groups, but what about the guy that's been laid off, a construction worker that's struggling to keep his mortgage going and he's short for a couple months and could use a teeny bit of assistance? What makes him any less important on a short-term basis. So, you know, I mean, I think we just have some things that we should be looking at. Other communities handle it a little bit different, and I think we should
Well, you know, given that the United Way has met their goal, increasing goal year after year, maybe we need to look within at our marketing efforts, our focus, naming, as you say, and basically figure out a better way to do this.
I agree.
Getting the word out.
And the need. Yeah.
The churches provide, some of the churches provide some utility assistance. Do you have any idea of how much assistance they provide to the 90% that you don't?
It's kind of hard to quantify. I would say actually fewer churches are doing that now than back when I started in this field. Love Inc. does a little bit for people they're working closely with. Salvation Army really is not doing much utility assistance anymore, neither is Voluntary Action Center. And the reason is it is such a huge need that I think people feel like they can't begin to address the needs. So really these days it's mainly down to our programs and then Central Missouri Community Action. I mean, by a large amount, those represent the bulk of the funding. So.
Is there any coordination between the cash help type programs and the energy conservation programs that the city has? Is there any
We
think there?
For homeowners, we definitely refer folks to weatherization. We've not gone so far as requiring a weatherization or energy audit. That's certainly, I think, something we should look at possibly going forward. You know, but the vast majority of people we're helping are renters. And certainly that's something we've talked about over the years is how do you handle rental properties with high, you know, utility bills.
And then the second piece to that is that if you talk to the staff that have been doing this for a number of years, Steve going all the way back to when he started with us even, a lot of times you'll have same property, different tenant year after year. So, I mean, it's not even just a matter of it's the tenant's problem. The tenant just happens to live in a property that is not very efficient, and so we see them coming back again and again. So we're trying to work. That's one of the things we've been doing with some of the other people in other departments is trying to capture where those are so that we can try to make some recommendations that have broader policy implications.
And not to make light of it, but when it comes to the resource issue, being a person that raises money, grant funds, and fundraising, it ain't easy to raise money for government as compared to being in a nonprofit. So when I do fundraising, I you know, that is a bit of a challenge trying to fundraise for a government entity, and that's just the reality of our world.
Maybe we have the wrong focus. Maybe it needs to be individual focused with names and faces as opposed to utility department.
We're in the research mode now. We're casting around the country looking for other models than what we've used, and so I throw that out as something you can expect to see when we come back is pretty well informed ideas. The other one is you know, we do experience donor fatigue pretty significantly here. I think that's the number one reason we have 30% more people and 30% less dollars flowing in. It's because United Way is doing so well compared to others, and quite honestly, all of the other nonprofits that are doing better than they used to. Some don't exist that did before, so it's a crowded marketplace, so to speak.
I'm interested in the problem you mentioned of the same different tenants coming back with the same property. I don't know if there's anything in the code or anything that we could add to the code that would address that. You know, because I mean, there's no law that says
that you have to.
There's a minimal efficiency or anything, but some of the houses I've seen are really deplorable. And
well, and then, you know, I mean, if you look at the housing stock and you look at some of the older homes that were built before some of the more, you know, weatherized and tighter, I mean, so that's to be expected. But, you know, I mean, I think that one of the things is that there are some landlords that work really hard to try to have a good environment, keep things up, recognizing that they want to keep good tenants. And then, you know, there are others that just charge rent.
town.
You know, the model is tough, too. As a rental, you know, the owner generally, that's something the tenant pays, but the tenant's not motivated to make much of a capital investment in the unit. So it's kind of this weird gray area where you can't just count on the market to fix it where it normally would. So that's one thing we have to sort of figure out and look for other models that work a little better. It may be that rental code is a place to look.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know.
I've even thought
in a way,
you could
go ahead.
I thought maybe even some, one of the options we could look at is how do you incentivize a landlord to rather than you know, the carrot and the stick model rather than a stick, are there ways that we could incentivize landlords to?
Right, because in a way you're helping the landlord by making their property a better property.
Which long-term helps.
I mean, even if you force them to do it, you're forcing them to do something that's going to give them a better quality tenant and a more stable tenant environment. So, but yeah, I agree with you that, I don't know, maybe there's some way to apply some of the weatherization to this too. That'd be interesting to see what you come up with.
Yeah, well, you know, we've toyed off and on with making energy efficiency of rental units more transparent, and we've really never been able to come up with a model. If you have a free market approach, which is to say let the buyer beware, the buyer would go to the landlord and say, I want to see the utility bills. Well, but we know that doesn't happen. Pardon me? Well, they, you know, are they doing it? Are they required to do it?
They can come to the city and get
they can.
Utility bills. For the
I'm saying they can. I'm also saying that it's possible there are individuals living on the edge trying to get by from month to month who make a decision based on the lowest rent number you can come up with.
Right.
Deferring the energy efficiency numbers till later, until February rolls around, and holy cow, now what do we have? And so, the free market would require that renter to do the due diligence herself, but you know, it's not happening.
No.
And so again, that lends itself back to the issue of how much do we interfere with the due diligence of the free market? I mean, is that an obligation that we have to publish or make transparent the energy, expected energy costs of the apartments you're renting? Now, I know that we've struggled with that, and it's a shame there is no model that allows that.
And I think the other thing, not only is the part about doing the due diligence and you're right, people living right on the edge, being able to barely make it, you know, month to month. But then you also have tenants that they're so on the edge that their credit is poor and their ability to even have many housing choices
right.
are so limited. So, you know, you put a single mom and her kids, she wants a roof over her head.
Taking what she can get and hoping.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I know you're going to talk about affordable housing, but the student population creates a very difficult rental market for low-income persons in our community in particular. And then one other factor is the gas bills, because most people, a lot of people heat with gas, and we cannot easily access those records. So that's been a real challenge over the years.
Other comments, questions?
It sounds like you'll be looking into a combination of approaches and including some energy efficiency, possible more information on what the average heating bill is for a certain square unit so people at least can compare, letting them know where to go to get that information. Possibly, I think some communities use some type of voluntary rating system so people can get on a list to say, you know, we're above the average or above for heating or something.
We know the problem with publishing utility bills because you don't know if the previous renters were four college students who had the thermostat set at 78 and kept the doors open. And so we have, there's really no way to, and I know the landlords are nervous about being judged incorrectly or inappropriately, but
well, And I can't imagine there aren't privacy issues, because the prospective tenants asking the future tenant for the data of the prior tenant.
Right.
I don't know, maybe there aren't privacy issues.
Well, I think, you know, our discussion has been that we'd like to really come back with something that just really not just looks at cash and how, but really looks at the system and how do we try to maximize what we have. And
I just had a picture in my head after this conversation about, you know, the GIS product we've just rolled out for the community, where you type in an address and all this information comes in that we have, who your council member is, what their garbage gets picked up. I could see a line in there that says, you know, last 3 years average, you know, utility bill. Say the caveat, this is not necessarily heat. Something like, we'll take a look and see what we can come up with. Yeah.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, it's least information that they can use to ask further questions. Yeah.
Well, all of us were unsophisticated college students who looked at the difference between $400 and $500 monthly rent and not much else, assuming that everything's the same. And it's not. So it would be nice if full disclosure, students, it would be nice if they would ask for full disclosure. And they may not get it, and in that case, they should go to an owner that would give it, but that's a larger issue. Any other comments or questions? Thank you, Stephanie and Darren. Appreciate it.
And finally, Councilmember Kessepol requested 5 minutes for Larry Grossman to present some information about the number of boards.
Good evening, Larry.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. My name is Larry Grossman, and I served on the governance committee of the visioning process. And it was a very interesting committee, because when we first got there, we looked around and saw the political persuasions of everybody and the difference of lifestyles, and really we wondered whether we would ever agree on anything. And we didn't agree for quite some time until we started looking at things from the constituents' point of view and how we can make the constituents more active in our community and more rewarded in our community. And then all of a sudden we started agreeing on things. We found a lot of things in common when we looked at it that way. One of the things that we as a committee, and by the way, I do not represent that committee. Committee is not functioning anymore. I was a member of that committee, and with me tonight are Dr. David Weber and former First Ward Councilman Larry Schuster, and we served on that committee together. One of the things that we recommended to the council is that we move ahead with expanding the council. We agreed on that. We did not agree. We had discussions, but we did not agree in that committee on whether that be two or four. Somebody might have even recommended more, whether those be elected at large or by adding new wards. And we came to the conclusion that we could not agree, and so we thought that would be a good thing for you guys to agree upon. And we made that recommendation, and today I'm here to ask you to further that recommendation. I think the citizens of this community would like to vote on changing the charter to allow for more representation, however that may be. I'll cut my time short so that the other gentlemen that are here can also speak. Dr. David Weber.
Good evening. Yes, I'm David Weber. I live at 302 Edgewood Avenue, which is in the fourth ward. As some of you know, I wrote a op-ed back in October in the Tribune about this issue. So while I was on also on the visioning committee, which is how I met these two gentlemen, I just sat down after I observed the redistricting with discussions over the summer and said, well, this problem could be recommended in two ways. One, there could be more council members, and secondly, the redistricting process could have been altered. But what I want to stress is two points. One, I looked around at other Missouri cities, and I was surprised that most of them have larger councils and have at-large members. Then I looked at the National City League, and 69% of mid-sized cities have either at-large or mixed election systems. Okay, so that's point number one that I want to leave you with. And then secondly, I've been surprised at the response that my column got. For example, I also mentioned instant runoff voting, and there were like three letters to the editor. And instant runoff voting, IRV, which Henry Lane, some of you I'm sure remember, used to advocate, is a rather technical thing. So I would say I've had probably 10 people make direct responses to me. I've written hundreds of op-eds over the years, and I've never gotten more than, say, five or six responses. So I think there is interest in this topic. So I encourage the council to move this discussion along. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Weber. I would invite Larry, you want to speak? And Carl, do you want to say? Sure.
David, former councilman, fellow council members. There's room at the council table for three more seats without any construction considerations. So one of the things that I...
be 10.
What's that?
That would be 10.
That would be 10. Number. You could do 9, you could do 10. I'm always in favor of odd numbers, but regardless. One of the things that when I was served in from 1990 to 93, we utilized a more target type districting where everybody had a little bit of piece of the central part of the city. And then we decided that we needed to give the central city more of its own representation. As with a lot of things that we do, some of our experiments don't have the consequences that we intend. But when we add council members, what we do is we do involve more people. And one of the things that I've always emphasized is that local government has more impact on our lives on a day in and day out basis than the federal government that we all can complain about together, and state government pretty much the same way. So the more we can engage our citizens and give them opportunities, the better things seem to run. And so whether it's at large or more wards, I'm in favor of either one of them just to expand the council. So I spent 25 years on the corner of Grand and Forest. And it's interesting to work 25 years in the first ward there and watch the dynamics of it. It gives you a unique perspective as you watch first graders become high schoolers that in the neighborhood. The needs aren't as easily met just from one council person. They're great. There's a lot of things that happen even just when you're trying to do a good job. So the more soldiers on the front line, the better. Thank you.
Well, I hadn't anticipated this, but nonetheless, a couple of things just to correct the record that Dr. Weber was suggesting. He did cite the 69% of communities that have at-large appointments on their city councils. I might add that we do as well. The mayor is an at-large appointment, so they would be amongst those 69% that he cited. This has come up on occasion. My wife had the privilege of serving on that same committee with Mr. Schuster and Mr. Grossman and Dr. Weber. And we have had a bit of a conversation about this as a result of the editorials. Hank Waters also had an editorial endorsing Dr. Weber's position. Her recollection, and in fact what was written in the visioning statement that came out of this group, did not suggest, there was no consensus as to whether or not the city council ought to be made larger. the consensus was that the city council ought to appoint a commission to look into it. That's what the visioning report says. Now, whether and that determination, of course, is entirely up to the council, given the recommendation of whatever council they decide to appoint. They may very well come down with a recommendation that that's not necessary. And I submit, from my own point of view, I don't see an issue really. Although we have grown by 28% in the last 10 years, I think the issue that brought this about had a lot to do with access to council members. I think a lot of that access question has been addressed by previous and this council in terms of council members making themselves available, with office hours, regularly scheduled office hours. And frankly, I think a group, the seven number, works well and should continue as long as it does work well. There comes a point at some point, probably when you have to increase the numbers, and certainly staying under double digits is probably preferable. The mayor knows very well that one of his goals was to reduce some of the times of the meetings. He has done so successfully, except on my one visit a couple of weeks ago when that one went to 1 o'clock. That was like old times. But nonetheless, I think that the number seven is a very workable group, and it makes a lot of sense to me. I don't really see any reason to increase it. The whole issue of at-large appointments is could be another can of worms, not necessarily. It might resolve some issues in redistricting, but it also tends to favor those with, I would call them deep pockets, or at least a lot of money to run a campaign, because an at-large campaign costs sufficiently more money than does a ward campaign, as the mayor can also attest at the last election. So that's my view on it. And you might want to take a look at the visioning document that really was the consensus document that came out of this committee. Thank you.
Larry? Go ahead.
Once again, I reiterate the visioning committee did, by consensus, agree that the council should be larger. In one of our action statements, we asked the council to appoint a committee to continue to investigate this. So both what Carl says and what I said are actual, factual. Thank you.
Council? Comments?
Well, I had a question of Dr. Weber on your 69% of mid-sized communities that have members at large. Was that including people that are cities that have one member at large versus, up to three or four or five or all?
Well, the fact that I recall, and I would have to check that, and I could send it to you, is 69% have either at large or mixed. All the ones that I look, I think all the cities I looked at in Missouri have at large members or multiple members per ward. Like Jefferson City has five wards and two members per ward, I believe. But most of single member per ward is unusual.
Okay, but your percentage includes communities that just have one at large.
I would have to examine that, but I don't recall off the top of my head.
Okay,
it's at large or mixed system.
I'd be interested in getting that.
I've forgotten if it was your report or somebody else's, but it seemed to me that several of the cities had several at-large members.
Yes. Most, all the ones I recall have more than one at-large person, so that would include other than the mayor, but I would I'll check that part.
Thanks. What would you suggest is the motive from a political science standpoint, that minorities that are dispersed would be represented?
Yeah, well, I think historically the concern has been that geographic concentrated minorities' interests would be flooded if it was at large. So our concern has been how to protect those. So I think a mixed system is what I would prefer, keeping wards and adding members to that. But I would agree, My biggest, I mean, my number one priority would be increasing the size of the council, and then I'm more open to how exactly to do that. But I think some wards need to exist, I mean, to protect minority interest.
How many does Des Moines have?
Seven.
And there are 210,000?
Four wards and three at large. And
three at large?
205,000.
Okay. An interesting proposition. I guess I don't have clarity, and I have to think about this. I don't have clarity as to the problem we're fixing by expanding to nine wards. As I think about it, I still feel pain over the reapportionment. And the amazing amount of work that people put in and how difficult that was. I think we have some really fairly balanced wards. I mean, look at the close races we've had. I mean, a council member who doesn't pay attention to his or her constituents is going to be in trouble given the close races that we've had. So it's if you think that you can go to nine and come up with a couple of safe wards, that might be problematic. You also open up issues like, well, let's put all, there are a couple of areas in town where it's all students. I mean, you could, if you wanted, create a ward, particularly south, with a huge student population and basically be begging or asking for a student representative on the council. I mean, I'm just saying that there are a lot of these things that are out there.
The other thing is that a change in the charter is not something to be taken lightly. We have a concise and well-written charter. It's sort of like a constitutional amendment, and so we should take that very seriously. It just so happens that this is in the charter instead of by ordinance, but that's a serious business to open up the charter.
Like you, I'm a little reluctant to change a system that, I mean, this is a group that is a pleasure to work with. I mean, highly engaged people. I'm
inclined to agree with, this has also come up every time reapportionment has come up, and I think it comes up many elections. It will be an ongoing issue.
We can take it under advisement, and if somebody has a strong feeling, you know, in a couple of weeks or 4 weeks, we can always form a commission. Mm-hmm. I don't have that strong feeling myself.
I can just say two things. I think the advent of email and a variety of communication technologies has really increased the ability of council members to hear from their constituents and communicate with their constituents. So that's made constituent services faster and better and easier. And I agree with the mayor. You know, we've just come out of a very contentious reapportionment issue, and I think we should just take a step back and maybe in a couple years or a year down the line, you know, if there seems to be a great need for it, to pursue it. But I don't see that great need right now either, and I think it would be very contentious to start that process again right now.
The reason I'd ask for them to come and speak tonight was the visioning committee had suggested that be looked at, and the city council has not done that. And I think if we value their work of the visioning committee, we need to have a work session on it or discuss it and see what we want to do at their recommendation.
Bring it up at a work session, and it just takes one council member to move to form a commission. So, any other issues? Let's take a 10-minute break and try to start promptly on time. Thank you.